Hello, Radio World. Casey here with another episode of Movieland on CITR 101.9 FM. This is the third episode of the show, and the first one of 2016. I started this show in the last week of 2015, not too long ago, and shared with you some of my favorite holiday films that aren't so obviously Christmassy. Now, if you at any point want to listen to those episodes, you can, thanks to the internet, at movieland.tumblr.com. Today, I'm going to talk about the recent Hollywood release, Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight. And as I'm going to spend the whole show talking about it, in relation to the rest of what I know or think I know about Tarantino, I have to warn you that there will be some spoilers. So if you haven't already, go see the film. It's worth it. I think he's becoming more and more of a you either love him or hate him kind of artist, and I love him. So already, I saw this movie twice. The first time on Christmas Day. Let me set up the scene for you. I woke up groggy and hungover from Christmas Eve and walked to the Park Theater for the first showing of the film in 70mm at 2 p.m. I did not even have a coffee before I left home. I figured the walk would wake me up and burn off the hangover a little bit, and that I would have time to hit the Starbucks or JJ Bean close by. And I was truly awake and ravenous from the uphill walk. So the movie was for 2 p.m., and I got there at 1 p.m., thinking I had lots of time. And it actually made me happy to see that there was already a lineup of about 30 people when I arrived, standing outside in the cold on Christmas Day to see this film. It made me feel cozy to see that other people cared enough about a filmmaker who cares enough about a particular kind of filmmaking to line up on its opening day. Now, what kind of filmmaking I think Tarantino cares about? That is what I will be exploring today. Anyway, I joined the line, and I had bought my ticket on the internet, and after about 15 minutes of waiting, a theater attendant comes out and informs everyone, kind of one by one going through the lineup, who had bought a ticket online, that there was a booking ID, and that we have to go inside and print it out from the Cineplex kiosk. I'm telling you these minute details of my first viewing of Hateful Eight as a personal PSA, so that the next time you are lining up for a movie and are there by yourself, you go to that stupid kiosk first, so you won't have to go back to the end of the line after. Okay, I go inside and stand in the kiosk printing line, which is such a stupid system, Cineplex. If you are listening, dear God, it's me, Margaret. Please fix this. Make it more efficient somehow, because it sucks. Anyway, I'm standing there in the kiosk line, and the silver lining of all of this is I get to watch these really young, gangly, like they're probably in their teens, theater attendants lug up a reel of 70mm film. And I've never seen 70mm film before. It's like 5 feet by 5 feet and like 10 inches deep. I don't even know how much that thing weighs. And it has 4 rubber bulges on one side in a square to, I don't know, like act as handles or cushioning or something. And these two kids struggle with it up the few steps from the lobby to the cinema interior. And they're like super clumsy with it. Clearly, this is their first time encountering a reel of 70mm film. Like mine too. It made me think of like a baby deer learning how to walk with a 70mm reel of film added to the mix, or watching baggage throwers tossing luggage into a plane while having a giggling fit about it. It was pretty surreal, a little bit frightening, and pretty funny seeing this still hungover, still uncaffeinated, first thing in the morning basically. So in a way, the lineup was actually worth it, I guess. After this, I go back to the end of the line, and not before too long, it moves, and I make it to my seat. I think it's just, you know, first thing in the morning, I'm super annoyed with everything, and want a coffee so bad, and a theater attendant telling me to go somewhere to do something I find completely redundant is not what I want. If the theater attendant brought me, like, a hot cup of coffee and then asked me to do it, I probably would have been like, sure. Anyway, the theater is pretty chaotic with people standing around, getting popcorn, looking for their friends, and then this guy, Buddy, makes his way to a seat, the row in front of me, like one seat over to the right of where I'm sitting, and he's wearing a top hat. Like, I wasn't sure if this was a fan thing, you know, when, like, you saw someone dressed up as Legolas at the Lord of the Rings, or if it was just, you know, his Christmas winter top hat. He didn't really block my view, but I wondered how long it would be before the guy beside me said anything. And it was when the film finally started that he said something. That was the circumstance of my 70mm screening experience. And I was lucky, as it turns out, because the projector was goofing later for a couple of days. Actually, during my screening, too, the screen turned black for a minute or so. I was annoyed, like everyone else, but I'm not a projectionist and have no idea how much of a challenge 70mm film is. So I looked it up. I came across this article online called What It's Like to Be a Hateful Eight 70mm Projectionist with Quentin Tarantino Watching, and it gave me a lot of sympathy for the hiccup. Here is a nice passage from the article by the projectionist, Adam Whitmer. The job of a projectionist is to manage and fix problems as they arise without the audience being aware. We are the buffer between the chaos of the projection and their experience. Every time a show needs to switch to DCP because of a problem, or a show shut down for a technical issue, there have been 10 equally large issues that the projectionist has already covered. Many of these projectors are practically antiques. The platter systems were never intended to support the weight and size of 70mm film, and entire new pieces of equipment had to be specially manufactured for this production. Because of this, dozens of tiny mechanical failures are bound to happen, and part of our job is to make sure these small issues don't propagate into catastrophes. Just today, I've had a lamp shift slightly to the right, creating a vignette effect at the left of the frame, a fuse blow, and a lens slightly scoot forward in its housing, causing me to have to refocus and tighten it down. Film is a temperamental medium. It doesn't always want to do what you want it to. There's a lot of sweat and dedication behind the glass in the back of that auditorium, and that is often overlooked. The projectionist is the pickiest one in the entire crowd, and we do everything we can to uphold the quality standards we so often fail to see in modern megaplexes. The Hateful Eight looks incredible projected at 70mm, and the difference between the print and the DCP are striking. The print's colors are more saturated, the blacks are blacker, the whites are whiter, and the entire thing is much crisper and, for lack of a better word, deeper. The DCP looks flat and washed out. But along with that quality difference comes a need for finesse and care on the part of the projectionist. We are human, and these systems are only machines. It's the price we pay for that beautiful quality image, but it's undoubtedly worth it, and I think audiences are starting to understand that. Yeah, so that article is online. I think I saw it on IndieWire.com. You can check it out. It's quite good. It gives me a lot of respect for the projectionist behind the film. So back to Hateful Eight. The 70mm version came complete with an overture introduction on this red title card. Red as Santa, red as Satan, and a 12-minute intermission. And then I saw it again a week later, on New Year's Day, surprisingly not hungover, on digital, and I have to confirm that yes, the 70mm looked phenomenal in comparison. Obvious to note, I guess, but film just moves differently through that projector, and the image was noticeably richer and more luminous. On digital, sometimes when there's a lot of sweeping motion in a scene, and I'm talking about all films here, the image on the slightly curved screen seems to move funny. Do you ever notice that? Like, it's not blurring or lagging necessarily, but it's just moving kind of funny, and sometimes I question my eyesight because of it. A film definitely does not do that. I am very happy I got to see it in 70mm, but sadly, I have to admit, uncaffeinated as I was, unbreakfasted too, and quite hungover, I dozed in and out during the first half for about 20 minutes and missed some of the clues and cues and backstories. And so the second half felt a bit flat, and I left the theater kind of disappointed. Like, what had I expected, I thought? Had Tarantino lost his perspicacity and depth? After seeing it again, I am happy to say, no, it's not him. It's me. I fell asleep, and we'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Wilson.
I'm Pramita.
You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Happy 75th birthday, CITR. All you need is love. All you need is love.
station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part four of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Man in the Morning.
Welcome back to Movie Land on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard the opening theme to the film Hateful Eight as recorded by me in the theater. So, Quentin Tarantino worked with the famous Italian composer Ennio Morricone, who did all the scores to spaghetti Western classics like Sergio Leone's The Dollars Trilogy. And The Hateful Eight was his first Western score since 1981, and it is very effective, as you just heard, in setting the tone. And that is one of the things Tarantino is so good at, pairing music to his movies. There is the infamous ear scene with Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs, Vincent Vega rolling in to pick up Mrs. Wallace, and Dusty Springfield is playing in her control room. Ugh. And then when she ODs, girl, you'll be a woman soon. The Delafonics in Jackie Brown, Hold Tight in Death Proof. I love these films where Tarantino is working in more realistic parameters. His characters live in a world very similar to the one that we do, closer to the time in which we live, whereas Kill Bill and Glorious Bastards and Django Unchained are far enough from the truth of the present moment that there is some more room for all the blood and guts and comic book treatment to read as funny as an alternate fantasy depiction of true historical trauma. Okay, get it. But his earlier work is more devastating, more profound somehow to me. The contrast between the punchy animated dialogue and the characters who speak them is more subtle. I hope he returns to this way of making films at least one more time. He said in an interview recently that he's going to stop after his 10th film, and The Hateful Eight is his 8th, so we will see. Okay, so Tarantino is really good at picking music. He is also an amazing dialogue writer in the vernacular of American English, the type from the golden age of Hollywood, like in the 60s and 70s. His films are filled with good stories and good storytellers, stories within stories, right? Par exemple, this is one of the diner scenes in Pulp Fiction at Jack Rabbit Slim's, a retro Americana diner where every employee is a 1950s celebrity and all the food have funny 50s names.
What do you think?
I think it's like a wax museum with a pulse.
Hi, I'm Buddy. What can I get you?
Let's see. Steak. Oh, yeah. The Douglas Sirk steak. Have that.
How do you want that cooked? Run to a crisp or bloody as hell?
Bloody as hell and, oh yeah, look at this, vanilla coat.
What about you, Peggy Sue?
I'll have the Durward Kirby burger, bloody, and a $5 shake.
How do you want that shake, Martin and Lewis or Amos and Andy?
Martin and Lewis.
Did you just order a $5 shake?
Mm-hmm.
That's a shake. That's milk and ice cream.
Last I heard.
That's $5. You don't put bourbon in or nothing?
No.
Just check.
I'll be right back with your drinks. To cry
my troubles away. Could you, roll me one of those, cowboy?
You can have this one, cowgirl.
Thanks.
Nothing up.
So, Marcella said you just got back from Amsterdam.
Sure did.
How long were you there?
Just over 3 years.
I'd go there about once a year to chill out for a month.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Why would you?
I heard you did a pilot.
That was my 15 minutes.
What was it?
It was a show about a team of female secret agents called Fox Force 5.
What?
Fox Force 5. Fox as in we're a bunch of foxy chicks. Force as in we're a force to be reckoned with. And 5 as in there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us. There was a blonde one, Somerset O'Neill. She was a leader. The Japanese fox was a kung fu master. The black girl was a demolition expert. French Fox's speciality was sex.
What was your specialty?
Knives. Character I played, Raven McCoy. Her background was she grew up raised by circus performers. According to the show, she was the deadliest woman in the world with a knife. And she knew a zillion old jokes. Her grandfather, an old vaudevillian, taught her. And if we would have got picked up, it would have worked in a gimmick where every show I would have told another joke.
You know any animal jokes?
Well, I only got the chance to say one because we only did one show.
Tell me.
It's corny.
Don't be that way. Tell me.
Nah, you wouldn't like it, and I'd be embarrassed.
You'd be embarrassed. You told I 50 million people, and you can't tell me? I promise I won't laugh.
That's what I'm afraid of, Vince.
That's not what I meant. You know it.
No, I'm definitely not going to tell you because it's been built up too much.
What a jip. Martin and Lewis. Vanilla Coke.
Yummy.
You think I can have a sip of that?
Be my guest.
I gotta know what a $5 shake tastes like.
You can use my straw. I don't have cooties.
Yeah, but maybe I do.
Cooties I can handle.
God damn, it's a pretty fucking good milkshake.
Told you.
I don't know if it was worth $5, but it was pretty fucking good.
Necessary to yak about bullshit.
When I first saw that, I don't know, as a teenager, I guess, I always thought she said comfortable silences instead of uncomfortable. So I just went along thinking like, oh yeah, she's really into that silence. And silence is always comfortable. It should never have to be uncomfortable, which is what she's saying. But I just got there in a different way. And just rewatching that scene on YouTube, I never noticed or had forgotten about this one strange moment where Buddy Holly hands her the milkshake. And before that, it's just medium close shots of the actor's faces cutting back and forth as they're talking. And as he hands her the milkshake, suddenly the camera's filming the scene from behind him. And it's got this strange hovering Steadicam way of being. It looks really out of sync with the rest of the scene. I wonder what that's about. Okay, so most of the things that come out of their mouths are cliches, and that's something Tarantino has a knack for, setting the tone for these cliches to be delivered without being simply cliches. They're referential to a time when they weren't cliches, when something close to a show like Fox Force 5 really did exist without being analyzed through the lens of history as campy. How it actually felt to be alive during what we perceive as the golden age of nostalgia, who even knows? Maybe Mad Men is a closer portrayal of that in its slow, episodic, things happen but things stay the same and just get more complex and wrung out kind of way. But how it feels watching actors reflexively enact that nostalgia while indulging in their nowness, which was back then the 1990s, with us watching now in 2016, feels very, very satisfying. It's irony and sincerity operating simultaneously. His characters retain their comic book lightness in face of whatever tense situation the director manifests. And when things aren't tense, they're extremely funny. The characters tell anecdotes and flaunt life opinions and philosophies unapologetically and stand by them. The most valiant of villains have set moral compasses that, in the end, don't amount to much. Here is the opening scene from his first film, Reservoir Dogs.
All right. I'll take care of the check. You guys can get the tip. Should be about $1 apiece. And you, when I come back, I want my book.
Sorry, it's my book now.
Hey, I changed my mind. Shoot this piece of
shit. All right, everybody cough up some green for the little lady. Come on, throw in $1.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
Do you know what these chicks make? They make
shit.
Don't give me that. She don't make enough money, she can quit.
I don't even know if you'd have the balls to say that. Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But, I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just doing their job.
Hey, this girl was nice.
She was okay. I mean, she wasn't anything special.
What's special? Taking the back and suck.
I'd go for 12% for that.
Look, I ordered coffee, right? Now, we've been here a long time. She's only filled my cup 3 times. I mean, when I order coffee, I want it filled 6 times.
6 times? Well, you know, what if she's busy?
Words too busy shouldn't be in a waitress's vocabulary.
Excuse me, Mr. Pink, but the last thing you need is another cup of coffee.
Jesus Christ, I mean, these ladies aren't starving to death. They make minimum wage. You know, I used to work minimum wage, and when I did, I wasn't lucky enough to have a job the society deemed tip-worthy.
You don't care they'd counting on your tips to live?
You know what this is? It's the world's smallest violin playing just for the waitresses.
You don't have any idea what you're talking about. These people bust their ass. This is a hard job.
So I was working at McDonald's, but you don't feel the need to tip them, do you? Well, why not? They're serving you food. But no, society says, don't tip these guys over here, but tip these guys over here.
Waitressing is the number one occupation for female non-college graduates in this country. It's the one job basically any woman can get and make a living on. The reason is because of their tips.
Call that.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I'm very sorry the government taxes their tips. That's f***ed up. That ain't my fault. I mean, it would appear that waitresses are one of the many groups the government f***s in the ass on a regular basis. I mean, if you show me a piece of paper that says the government shouldn't do that, I'll sign it. But to a vote, I'll vote for it. But what I won't do is play ball. And it's non-college bullshit you give me. I got 2 words for that. Learn to f***ing type. Because if you're expecting me to help out with the rent, you're in for a big f***ing surprise.
Just convince me. Give me my dollar back.
Hey! Leave the dollars there.
All right, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Ooh, I am so conflicted. Because I am a waitress, or using the gender-neutral term, I am a server. I do survive on tips, and I don't give any special service to get my tips. I'm college-educated, but hey, I like serving because these days it pays better than most jobs in my gloriously noble field of visual arts. And without going on a full-on digression into the messed-up, oxymoronic role culture plays in our society and my own willing participation within it, I see both sides of this ongoing dilemma of tipping, which Tarantino ostensibly uses to present social issues of class and gender and race through the white male gaze. A lot of women I know generally have a problem with his portrayal of them, of us. And I'm not black, so I don't want to go into a critique for or against his portrayal of black people in America just because it's too outside my life experiences. But as a woman, I do not have a problem with the female characters in his movies. I don't think I've ever even rolled my eyes at any female character in his movies, except for maybe Zoe in Death Proof, just because she was a little too spunky and I found her annoying as a human being. As for the violence the women are subjected to, I don't take it any more seriously than I take the violence the men are subjected to. And it makes me wonder, why are North American audiences perceived as being so incapable of discerning their own moral compass? Are we really that sensitive? But then when I'm watching Hateful Eight on New Year's, a few guys in the theater clap and whoop when Domergue is hung. And then I think, is that sensitivity a result of people like that? At least it wasn't the majority of the theater, right? It's like the same thing as that tipping scene. The violence in his films open up a debate that reveals the irreconcilability of society. I do not watch his films and think Tarantino is a racist or that Tarantino hates women. I think Lars von Trier hates women a little bit, but Tarantino, no. I think he has a peculiar sense of humor, very violent one, and I'm totally down with it. His films, his dialogue, his style remind me of Patti Smith's song, Rock and Roll Nigger. Charged, funny, powerful, irreverent. And it just so happens to be on the Natural Born Killer soundtrack, which Quentin Tarantino wrote the screenplay for. So let's listen to that before the commercial break.
Crazy and sleepy, Comanche, lies beneath this netting of skin. I wake up, I am lying peacefully, I'm lying peaceful and my knees are open to the sun. I desire him, he is absolute and ready to seize me. And in heart, I am Muslim, in heart, I am an American.
Yeah.
ends harm, also makes fervor. Blessed is the grass and herb and the tree of thorn and light.
Like Friends? Well, we like you, so become a member and get a Friends of CITR card. Not only does it make you special, but it gives you all kinds of deals with our friends on Main Street, including 10% off at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Red Cat Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and more. Visit CITR.ca for more, or come check us out in the Nest.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Welcome back to Movie Land. On CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Casey, and today I'm talking about Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight. So I really liked it, but it took me two screenings to get to this declaration of really like. The first time, well, I fell asleep, so I was missing some of the pieces, my fault, and in watching it twice, I realized that, for me, his films are always better the second time around. The first time, the plot is always at the forefront, and as light as his characters are, they're also very severe. That is, they find themselves in serious, desperate life or death situations. Sometimes a simple conversation scene is laced with a tension that just makes me squirm as much as horror movies do. Like, I had to cover my eyes in Jackie Brown in the last band scene with Ordell and Lewis. And I just have to add that I think there is a striking resemblance between Bob from Bob's Burgers and Lewis, played by Robert De Niro in Jackie Brown. See if you think so too the next time you watch those two back to back. Anyway, at his best, Tarantino's films are better the second time around, because once we are familiar with the story, all the high-stress suspense bits no longer come as such a shock, and our linear organization of his usually non-linear plots have happened, so we can pay more attention to the fine details. I always forget about his use of close-ups that fetishize objects and body parts, which some people are critical of, but I read them as ironic commercials, his play on commodity fetishism as much as maybe his sincere love of women's feet. But also, these shots fetishize styles of filmmaking as well, like the French New Wave, which he is so influenced by that he named his production company A Band Apart after a Godard film. And I don't think Tarantino reveres or fetishizes directors as much as he does genres. I don't mean this in a critical way, I just think that's what he does, instinctually. And it's how his films still retain his own personality. Worship a director and you're kind of doomed to try and recreate his style or her style, whereas a genre is broad and has room. Nobody has said absolutely everything about anything in a feature-length film. I think 2001, A Space Odyssey, and Mulholland Drive come close, but that's about it. The Hateful Eight is a good example of Tarantino's genre fetishization. It's a film that has resulted from the distilled combination of his love for spaghetti westerns, gory samurai films, and western TV shows. He said in an interview, quote, "I love it in a western, where you would pass halfway through the show to find out if they were good guys or bad guys. And they all had a past that was revealed. I thought, what if I did a movie starring nothing but those characters? No heroes, no Michael Landons, just a bunch of nefarious guys in a room, all telling backstories that may or may not be true. Trap those guys together in a room with a blizzard outside, give them guns, and see what happens." So, in his way, his eighth film was kind of a character experiment. It functioned like an Agatha Christie story, a whodunit clue mystery of who poisoned the coffee, and a bet in your head as to who would be the last man standing. It reminded me of Hitchcock's Rope and Robert Altman's use of multi-channel stereo sound. Tarantino doesn't push this film as far as he could have. I was expecting more in the gore department, and in the end, all the characters were kind of flat and too comic bookish for me to care much about them when they got killed. But there are definitely some wonderful moments that feel as powerful as what he has done in his earlier films, before the Kill Bills and the Inglourious Basterds and the Djangos. Like this.
John Ruth.
Yeah.
Can I play that guitar over there?
Yeah. You come back with anything else but a guitar. My pistol plays a tune. Dahmer Goo's Death March. You got it?
Yeah, I got it.
Rather drowned in misery than come to new sea.
the one you like to sing in the stagecoach, huh?
Yeah.
It's kind of pretty. Got another verse to it?
Yeah.
Go ahead, sing it.
Larry St. John. That day and night, the eye and leg and leg were guys loose. Toil and toil and winded, I must fill this all the graves. By and by, I'll break my chains into the bush, I'll go. And you'll be dead behind me, John, when I get.
That was Jennifer Jason Leigh as Daisy Domergue. Her character was so nasty and fierce. All the performances were awesome. Samuel L. Jackson as Major Warren, Kurt Russell as Hangman Bob Ruth, Bruce Dern as Colonel Smithers. Kurt Russell is so funny. He was such a softy underneath that gruff bounty headhunter facade. I really felt for him. Even in between all the times he punches Domergue in the face, I still felt a lot of sympathy for his character. There's a scene early on in the carriage on the way to beat the impending blizzard that ends with Domergue staring out into the snow, and it cuts to a close shot of the horses galloping to music that was very surprising to me. It gave so much room for the audience to feel the blizzard as a mood, as a character in the movie. It looks so great and majestic on 70mm, and I've never seen Tarantino do a scene like that close shot of just, like, a subject, the horses moving, kind of like a homage to Moybridge, almost, like, super beautiful. The blizzard howled all the way through the film and is the greatest opponent to them all in the end. And here's a scene of two characters striking a line from the cabin to the stable in preparation for the storm.
You go inside and get some hot coffee. Got some stew cooking. Should be done soon.
Now look, no matter how bad this blizzard gets, we still gotta feed these horses and take a squat from time to time. So me and Chris better lay out a line from the stable to the front door and from the front door to the shit house. Okay?
Good idea.
Come on, Chris.
I'll give you a hand. No. Go inside. Get warm.
You're doing stable work in a goddamn blizzard. I'm going to help you say no.
You're right, amigo. Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Some beautiful sound mixing there. Now, it occurred to me during the second screening of the film that I've developed an empathy for his reoccurring actors. And in those memories, I've developed my own personal nostalgia for any time that I see Samuel L. Jackson in one of his films. During the scene where he recalls his encounter with Chester, I was right back in the Big Kahuna Burger scene of Pulp Fiction. Tim Roth bleeding on the floor just reminded me of his tragedy in Reservoir Dogs, while the rest of the time his English dandiness took me back to Four Rooms. Six Horse Judy, it's Zoe, the annoying spunky gal in Death Proof. Annoying, but I felt for her lying there on the ground. There is very much the desire at the end of the film to just leave the theater with a satisfied sigh that yes, it was entertaining, and yes, now it's over, and back to the real world we go without giving much thought to what's going on in between the lines. Tarantino, since Death Proof and through Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, has been really delving into some heavy subject arenas. World War II and American slavery? Yeah. Because Hateful Eight was a very contained film with only eight principal characters, it could be read as a play, as an allegory. I think it's pretty meaningful how it ends with Warren and Mannix bleeding together on the bed, lulling themselves with Warren's fake Lincoln letter as the blizzard rolls on. I'm going to leave you with that thought today and end with Morricone's overture from this film. Yeah, that's it for now. I'll be back soon to talk about I'm not sure what, maybe something I've seen recently, or maybe Raymond Chandler. I've been thinking about Raymond Chandler a lot and his books and films. So yeah, tune in again to Movieland on CITR 101.9 FM. And you can also catch previous episodes of this show at movieland.tumblr.com. Bye for now.